Well, once again, it's a blessed morning we can be together. Always good to be with God's people, and especially on the Lord's Day. I want to step out of my role as the visiting preacher and kind of give an advertisement, which I'm sure Joe is building up, the coming of Marty and Russ for this eldership training weekend. What, the 1st of November, is that right? I was there at Embry Hills when the genesis of this took place. Marty and Russ are two of the elders at Embry Hills, and I was working there as an evangelist. And the idea was put forward, you know, where are the future elders going to come from? And they decided to meet with some guys, usually just six or seven at a time, before church started. So we start at 9. They would meet at 7:30. So it was a long day for those guys, but those guys would show up at 7:30, and for an hour and a half, for several weeks, they would meet with the elders, and Marty and Russ did most of the material, putting this together. But they would talk about the importance of shepherding, and the importance of preparing yourself when you're young to be that, because shepherds don't just pop out of a hat someday, you know, when they reach a certain age. It's something that you begin at a very early age, and you develop the qualities that you're going to need to be a shepherd. And I almost feel guilty because Russ and Marty both hold regular jobs. They're not supported elders, although I'm totally in favor of that. But they're not supported as elders there at Embry Hills. And when we moved over to Tuscaloosa, I said, hey, could you do this for us? Well, they came and did it, and the first session, half of the room was filled with elders who had come from many different churches to come hear this series, and it dawned on me what a void there is in our preaching. We have all of these schools and all of these lectureships and all of these camps and different things we do to prepare young men to be preachers. Well, where are the same emphasis on preparing men to be elders? And so I saw then, especially at the eager participation of all these elders, they were so excited about this. I thought, and I apologized to Marty and Russ that week, and I said, I'm so sorry, I've just made your life so much busier than it already is. And they're already getting requests from several different places to come and do this material. But I'm saying all that to say, make your plans. If at all possible, to be there as much as you can on Saturday and Sunday, you will be blessed by this series. Well, as it was mentioned, we're going to be continuing in our talk about marriage, looking at the fruit of the Spirit, and our goal, let's just state it again, can't state this too much, is not just to have happier marriages. Our goal is to grow. And God has given us marriage as a kind of gymnasium to exercise the fruit of the Spirit and to grow in our relationship with Him. And we've talked throughout about how the flesh and the Spirit are opposed to each other. This is a constant battle. Never ends. We see that man put to death in baptism. We're buried with Christ. That old man of sin dies, body of sin with it. But it's almost like Night of the Living Dead. It's a man that dies a thousand deaths. We have to keep putting him to death and putting him to death. And it's manifested in marriage, perhaps more than any relationship, any other relationship, this struggle we have with the flesh. And we've talked about what marriage is fundamentally. We talked about the calculus of marriage. 1 + 1 = 1. When we talk about marriage, the two, Jesus said, quoting from Genesis chapter 2, became one flesh. So they are no longer two, they are one flesh. And the man and his wife were both naked and not ashamed, we looked at this morning. What a beautiful thing that was, and something just unimaginable to us living in a world of sin. What would marriage be like? What would any relationship be like if there was no sin? What would that be like to be naked and not ashamed? But unfortunately, because of the tempter, they partook of the fruit, and their eyes were open, and they knew that they were naked. And that not only created a separation between man and God, it created a separation between man and man, and even husband and wife. We see evidence of that even in the conversation they had with God in Genesis 3. And one of the results, this is not the curse. The curse had everything to do with the pain and the sorrow that the woman would deal in childbirth and the man would deal in working the fields. But one of the consequences of sin is this strain on the marriage relationship where the woman desires her husband and he'll rule over her. This is not, again, headship. Headship was established in creation. This is a perversion of what was in the garden when they were naked and not ashamed. There's a separation. And yet, because of Christ giving us the example on the cross, when we submit to our roles in marriage, we can return to the garden. We can again restore that relationship where the husband freely loves his wife and she no longer feels insecure, desiring her husband, wanting to control him, and she respects her husband. And he no longer feels like he has to keep her under his thumb. We can reverse the curse. This downward spiral in marriage that we see in our own marriages, when we see especially people who are going through very difficult times, because one is insecure and the other is trying to control and manipulate, it keeps going down. But when we replace that with love and respect, it goes away. But of course, it's not that easy. I mean, this looks all very simple on a chart, right? We know it's more difficult than that. And that's because we're sinners. We're broken people, broken because of sin. I think one of the most fascinating examples of this brokenness can be found in the book of Job. Job is very much a commentary, you could say, on the fall, on the consequences of the fall. Only Job receives all the consequences, it seems like, at once, in one day. He loses everything. Every painful thing you could imagine happening to you in life happens to him in a single day. But you know what one of the most painful things was? It was when his wife came to him and said, "Curse God and die." And we have to be careful in our judgments of Job's wife. Job looks very good, and she looks very bad in this. But let's not forget that she lost her children too. And we can't even imagine, especially those of us who have never lost a child, but imagine losing all of them at once, how difficult that would be. But still, she said it. And you know, you come to the end of the story, and chapter 42 sounds so good because God vindicates Job's righteousness before his friends. And he, more than that, restores all that Job lost. Gets new cattle, gets new children. But you know what? He had the same wife. And think about that. Whatever went on during those days, and after when she said what she did, and even after all the things were restored, you understand that things don't mend a broken heart. Sometimes we think they do. Sometimes we think we can just go on a spending spree and yeah, that'll make us feel better. But it's only for a time. That's just a momentary pleasure. No, their relationship was strained. And they had to work it out. And so what we're going to be talking about in the next two lessons is what do we do married to a broken person, ourselves being broken, and we need to remind ourselves of that. It's easy to see the brokenness in them. But what do we do? You know, this love and respect, what does that look like in practical terms? Well, that brings us to the next two characteristics of the fruit of the Spirit, and that is patience We're going to talk about now, and then kindness. We'll talk about later this evening. Stephen Covey, in his book, The Seven Habits, says that we all have an emotional bank account. It begins on a neutral balance with someone else. Okay, so you start out even. But you make deposits, and you make withdrawals. All of us, or my relationship with all of you, was on a neutral balance. The only thing you knew about me is what Joe had told you about me. And so maybe I came in with a little bit of equity. As we have spent this weekend together, you've been making deposits in me, and I've been making deposits in you, hopefully. I hope I haven't been withdrawing anything. But that's what we do in any kind of relationship, and especially in marriage. And these emotional units are units of trust. The more you invest, the more trust you build into the relationship. Positive reserve builds tolerance and goodwill. You can do something that is harmful in the relationship. You can utter a single angry word. But if you've got enough equity in the bank, that'll be forgiven, right? You know what I'm talking about. The more you've invested into the relationship, the more equity you have, the more trust that's in the relationship, well, then there's a little more leeway with tolerance and goodwill. But negative withdrawals deplete that confidence so that a single angry word can be something that is not quickly forgotten. But you'll remember that maybe for the rest of your life. That's the way our heart works. And that's why these lessons are so important. Patience and kindness. If marriage is an automobile, patience would be the brake where you avoid that big crash, where you utter that single angry word and wreck your marriage. And kindness would be the accelerator where you make the marriage go. And so we're going to start with patience this morning and talk about how we hold back and keep ourselves from saying things and doing things that can ruin our marriage. Because we are, like Job and like Job's wife, in a relationship that's imperfect. And we do sin. And we hurt when we sin against one another. And so how do we keep those things from hindering our relationship from being what God wants us to be? I want to give some suggestions on things we can do to be patient with one another. I think, first of all, we need to recognize the priority of what we're doing. Take your Bibles and turn over to Matthew chapter 5. In Jesus' Sermon on the Mount, Jesus talks about anger, and that's the enemy. That we're most talking about tonight. Anger is such a problem in marriage. And Jesus says about anger in verse 21, "You have heard that it was said to those of old, 'You shall not murder, and whoever murders will be liable to judgment.' But I say to you that everyone who is angry with his brother will be liable to judgment. Whoever insults his brother will be liable to the council, and whoever says, 'You fool,' will be liable to the hell of fire. So, if you are offering your gift at the altar and there remember that your brother has something against you, leave your gift there before the altar and go. First, be reconciled to your brother and then come and offer your gift. Come to terms quickly with your accuser while you're going with him to court, lest your accuser hand you over to the judge and the judge to the guard and you be put in prison. Truly, I say to you, you will never get out until you have paid the last penny." Did you know that this is talking about marriage? mean, it's talking about every relationship. But this is talking about marriage. In fact, one of the best sermons I've ever heard on marriage was a sermon that really just looked at the Sermon on the Mount and applied all of these principles. Sewell preached that lesson. I think he stole it from someone else. But still, it was just one of those lessons. You're like, well, of course this is talking about marriage. Where do we get the most angry? I think I talked about it earlier that, you know, you can be driving down the road and someone yell an obscenity at you. And it makes you upset for a little while. Hopefully you don't experience the road rage that we've seen on TV where people are shooting each other and things like that. But typically that's something that just upsets you for a while. You get over it. And the reason why we get over it is because we don't know them. There's no bank account. There's no emotional connection with that person. You can just easily dismiss that and say, well, you know, I don't care about them. They mean nothing to me. I'm going to move on. But when that same obscenity is uttered by your spouse, that's a totally different story, is it not? It's totally different. And that's why anger is such a problem in marriages. And did you notice what Jesus' solution is to anger? I mean, first of all, he says, you need to take this seriously. Don't be like the legalistic Pharisees who have interpreted the law to say, well, as long as you don't kill them, you're okay. And unfortunately, that's the way we treat our spouses sometimes. I didn't start this. I'm just going to sit over here silently. I didn't hit her. I didn't do anything to him. And we think that that passive kind of reaction is adequate. Jesus says, no, it's not. We're going to talk later about loving your enemies in an active sense, not just a passive, not doing anything to them. But he says it's not just the murder that you commit physically. It's what you have in your heart. He says what's wrong and what's sinful is the anger itself. And when that anger manifests itself in any form, you're liable to judgment. By the way, this is the first time he mentions the hell of fire in this sermon. Talking about anger. Anger can send you to hell. And it's something Jesus says you need to take care of. He says in verse 23, so, because of this, if you're offering your gift at the altar, and there remember that your brother has something against you, leave your gift there before the altar and go. First be reconciled to your brother, and then come and offer your gift. What he's saying, let me interpret that. What he's saying, don't come to church with that on your heart. God's not going to listen to your prayers. He's not going to hear your singing. He's not going to be honored by anything that you do. Leave your gift at the altar. First do what? Reconcile with your wife. Make it right with your husband. Whatever it is, take care of it. It's that serious. It's that important. And so what we're talking about here, when we talk about patience and kindness, are not small things with God. They're essential. Tomorrow night, we're going to talk about faithfulness. And for many, that's about the only thing that's important. As long as I don't divorce them, right? As long as I remain married until death, and thank God when that happens, when that ball and chain is broken, as long as I stick with them, God's happy. No, God's not happy. God created us to be one. The two became one. And when we're not one, God's not happy. And so we need to work on this. What are some things that we can do? Well, I'm just going to draw out some wisdom from the Proverbs. Proverbs are rich. So much wisdom. That's a great, if you're having problems with a child, if you're having problems in any relationship with your spouse, just go to the Proverbs. Read the Proverbs. You can read a chapter a day, a chapter for each day of the month. And read that and see if it doesn't help Infuse your relationships with new wisdom. And here's a great piece of wisdom. We used to share this with our children a lot, still do. But Proverbs 17 and verse 14 says, starting a quarrel is like breaching a dam. So drop the matter before the dispute breaks out. We would say, don't sweat the small stuff. The story is told about a couple that was trying to make their marriage work, and they had a fault box. And they said for a month, any grievance, any problem that they had, they were supposed to write down what that is and stick it in the box. And the point of that was, we're not going to express those things verbally and let that be contentious. We're going to let these small little annoyances, like you didn't leave, you didn't put up your dirty socks, or you didn't put the top back on the toothpaste, or something like that. Those little grievances, we're going to put those in the fallback box. And then at the end of the month, when we're thinking clearly and we're not emotional in the moment, we'll share those with each other, and we can fix these problems in our marriage. Well, they did that for a month. And at the end of the month, do you know what all the slips of paper said? They said, I love you. I love you. It's more important. Your relationship, your love is more important than those dirty socks on the floor. So I'm just not going to say anything. I'm not going to let little things come before us. It is like breaching a dam, though, isn't it? And how much of a crack do you need in a big, giant dam to create a problem? We got an engineer over here shaking his head, no. You don't want even a small little crack, because once you open that dam, you got problems. So stop the quarrel. Don't let little things come between you. Be patient. Listen. Proverbs 18 verse 13 says, he who answers before listening, that is his folly and shame. Do you know what the difference is between hearing and listening? And maybe I'm making a distinction that, you know, between hearing and listening, follow me. Just stay with me. Hearing is when you're just letting them talk and waiting until they get finished before you have to say what you're going to say, and you don't even know what they said. You were just taking a time out from talking. Listening is where you're not going to think about what you are feeling at all. And you're asking questions. And you're wanting to know, why are you so upset? What have I done? I know what you've done. I know what I'm feeling. I don't know what you're feeling, but I want to know what you're feeling, because we're one and I care about you. And I've hurt you in some way, but I don't understand why I've hurt you. And so I'm going to sit here and I'm going to listen and take as long as it takes for me to come to understand what you're trying to say. I can't tell you how important listening is. And good marriage counselors, when they talk about communication, this is what they're talking about. They're not talking about talking. I mean, that's the easy side of communication. We can all talk. Listening is the hard part. Listening is where we die to self. Listening is where you say, you remember the three types of marriages? You know, the type where you got two trying to win, and then the type of marriage where you got a winner and a loser. And then you got the type of marriage that Christ is calling us to, and that is where both lose. Where you go into the discussion saying, it is my goal to lose this argument. Have you ever thought of an argument in that way? I mean, how do you do that? I mean, what does that look like? I mean, that's antithetical to what an argument is. And in fact, it isn't an argument. If you go into the disagreement saying, I am going in this hoping to lose, what you're saying is, I'm putting your feelings and your desires and your thoughts ahead of my own. Imagine what would take place if we started listening in that way. But if you are going to speak, Be careful what you say. Proverbs 29, verse 22 says, reckless words pierce like a sword, but the tongue of the wise brings healing. That's those angry words that get us into so much trouble. We need to be careful about using absolutes in our speech. You always do this. You have never listened to me. And the reason why we overstate our case is because we suspect the other side is not listening to us. And so we exaggerate to make a point. The fact is, they don't always and never. You wouldn't have married them if that was the case. You know, at least at one time, you know, they did something. The fact is, we overstate our case. And guess what happens when we overstate our case? When we exaggerate like this? Well, your bank account is going down really fast when you start doing that. They stop listening. Because they judge, and rightly so, that you're being unreasonable, that you're being irrational, and that you're thinking about yourself. And not only be careful what you say, be careful how you say it. Proverbs 15 and verse 1, a gentle answer turns away wrath, but a harsh word stirs up anger. My father's father, my grandfather, used to be the guy that would work for the landlord, and he would go and fix problems. So if someone had a leaky faucet, the landlord would call him up and he'd go fix it. And he oversaw several houses. Well, he tended to see the worst in people, you know, when people were having a really bad day. And so, you know, he would show up at the house and they'd be all upset. And he said the secret to dealing with people when they're upset is lower your voice. When they get louder, you get softer. And he said they will always come down to you. And there's great wisdom in that, because it's based on this proverb. We need to be careful about our tone. We need to use a respectful tone. Wives, you can disagree with your husband. You're to submit, but you can disagree. Just be careful how you do it. Make sure that when you come to the table with your concerns and your thoughts and your ideas, and he needs to know your thoughts and concerns, because he is responsible for understanding you. 1 Peter 3 and verse 7. Make sure that when you come and disagree with your husband, you come with that meek and quiet spirit. And husbands, we need to deal with them in an understanding way, understanding that we are dealing with a weaker vessel. I don't think that that's saying that the woman is physically weaker. I think that's more talking about she is in a position of submission. You're in the position of authority. And you need to deal with her gently and seek to understand her and speak to her in a gentle way. Watch your emotions. Proverbs 15 verse 18 says, a hot-tempered man stirs up dissension, but a patient man calms a quarrel. It's so easy to lose your temper in the heat of the moment. And it's like you have this just bubbling up inside and you just got to get it out. You just got to get it out. Have you ever noticed how you feel about that the next day? Do you feel the same way? And have you ever noticed that when all this that you just got to get out, if you hold it in and not say anything, that the next day you're thinking, man, I'm glad I didn't say that. I am so glad I didn't say what I was thinking to say. And the fact is, once we have made that decision, usually what happens is we come to a better understanding. When we don't vent our anger and our emotions, we do eventually start to listen to the other side, and we get a context that helps us to deal with our negative emotions in the right way. So watch your emotions and wait. Proverbs 20 and verse 22 says, do not say, I will repay evil. Wait for the Lord, and He will deliver you. I read somewhere that the average yearly cost of running red lights is over 7 billion dollars. And that the average time saved by running red lights is about 50 seconds. I think that's classic. I think that describes America. It describes our culture. We just don't have much patience because we get everything instantly. Instant coffee, instant oatmeal, instant messaging, instant credit. You know, we don't want to wait. We want it right now. We want to resolve things quickly. Well, it doesn't happen that way. It doesn't happen that way. People take time to process things. People take time to heal. I've mentioned to you some of the ones that I've counseled, and they're just like so frustrated, and they're so angry, and they're so upset, and they want there to be a resolution. Why won't she forgive me? Why won't he get it? Why doesn't he not understand? Well, when you've dug yourself in that kind of hole, it takes a while to get out. Like the country boy said, Rome wasn't built in a day, but it sure can burn in a day. And it takes a while to build it back. And so be patient. Be patient. Don't expect too much of your mate. Remember that they're broken just like you are. And give them time. I thought long and hard about sharing with you this next slide. And I think you'll understand in a minute. Because it comes from Miley Cyrus, of all people. So just forgive me. But you know, this is a great song. There's always going to be another mountain. I'm always going to want to make it move. Always going to be an uphill battle, and sometimes I'm going to have to lose. It ain't about how fast I get there. It ain't about what's waiting on the other side. It's the climb. Now, she doesn't mean it in this way. But when we think about the climb, what are you and I thinking about? We're thinking about that upward call of God in Christ Jesus. The unfortunate fact is, you will never get in your marriage what you were made for. Now, marriage is a picture of what we're made for, that two becoming one. But don't expect your mate to be what only God can be for you. Your mate cannot replace the relationship that God created you for. A picture. But this is a broken person. And so we need to come into our marriages and approach them with a realistic expectation of how much they can give us. And only ask of God that ultimate satisfaction that He can give. But look at our marriage as a way to make that climb. Every time you show patience with your wife, every time you bite your tongue, every time you push down your emotions, every time you choose to lose and say, I'm going to let them win, every time you do that, you're getting a little higher up on that mountain. You're getting higher toward that apex, which is not the perfect marriage on earth. It's the marriage made in heaven. And so I pray that we'll all strive a little harder on that mountain, knowing what waits for us on the other side. Maybe that there's someone here, though, that hasn't even started on that mountain. It may be that there's someone here who's looking at the mountain and saying, I don't even belong there. I don't belong with these good people. I don't deserve to be here. But as our brother pointed out from Isaiah 42, and that's the first time I've ever heard Isaiah 42 used before the Lord's Supper, and I'm so thankful I did. That's a great, one of the great servant songs in Isaiah, and we only look at Isaiah 53. But what that tells us is that God is wanting to help us up this mountain. He is making a way for the blind. He's making a way for the deaf, and that's you and me. And with His help and by God's grace, we can make it up that mountain. And I'll clue you in about these good people. They're not as good as you think. And these marriages, you look at it and you say, oh, they must never have an argument. That's not true. It's not true. We're all broken people. This is a hospital, by the way. That's what we are. And we're all helping each other get up that mountain. But none of us can do it without Jesus. Jesus came and died so that we can make it up that mountain. And by His grace, by His mercy, your sins can be forgiven this day if you'll come to Him in faith. Trusting in Him, no longer yourself, giving up yourself, dying to self, crucifying yourself with Christ. Coming to Him and saying, I've made a mess of my life. I've tried to do things on my own and it has not worked. But I'm going to trust in You. And so I'm going to turn from my life of sin and repent. And I'm going to confess that You are Lord, that You're raised from the dead. And I'm going to die with You today in baptism. And You can rise to new life. If you're ready to do that this morning, why don't you come as we stand and sing?